Welcome back to Call Time with Katie Birnbaum. Thanks for all of the really great responses to the last episode of the podcast and to the last Arts Journal article, the love letter to the Hairspray vertical bed. It's so cool to see the stuff that I really care about and have obsessed over for years resonate with so many people, and it really means the world to me. So please keep reading and listening and commenting and reviewing. I want to hear more about you and what you, my listeners, want to hear and see. But I imagine you're going to really enjoy my next guest. We have peripherally known each other for several years now, and I have always been impressed by his multifaceted career. My guest describes himself as a multidisciplinary theater maker, director, and playwright who is the co-artistic director of Night Drive, a theater company that focuses on making genre-bending plays and events which focus on stagecraft. Some of these have included Providence, Rhode Island, which premiered at The Tank, Thank You, Sorry, which premiered at Ars Nova, and most recently, his sort of like outdoor pandemic play with my other dear friend, Abby Melick, The Grown Ups, which was performed first in their backyard for 10 people at a time during summer 2021, and then at Theater with a View in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, this past summer 2022. And finally, and perhaps most uniquely, my guest is, we'll see what we call it, an illusionist, someone who does magic, and a magician, but is currently the illusions and magic associate at Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, United States, which essentially means he helps create all of the magic and stagecraft effects that you may have seen on one of the Harry Potter stages. I'm so excited to discuss all this and more today. So without further ado, Skylar Falk.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
It's a pleasure. Is there anything in your bio that I biffed?
No, you got it so right. I make my weird little plays, my company Night Drive, and my co-artist director, Simon Enriquez, and then magic for other people's plays.
Fantastic. I do have to ask, do you consider yourself a magician?
Oh, that is such a good question. I grew up doing magic. I started doing magic when I was 4 years old, and I asked my parents for a street performing license for my birthday when I was turning eight, and started street performing then. And, you know, use it as a way to like save money towards college, towards future things, right? And then I gave it up at a certain point because around the same time I started doing magic, I fell in love with theater. And magic is something you mainly do on your own, and theater is something you make with other people. And I really liked the feeling of making things with other people and really wanted to be a director and writer. And then, well, I look back and realize I was using magic as a director as a way to solve impossible problems on stage for years and years and years. But if you'd asked me at the time, I would say, I don't do magic. I never do magic. I do theater. And then Harry Potter came along and it kind of reopened that well-healed wound. And now I don't know if I call myself a magician, but I definitely call myself illusions and magic director and designer.
Very cool. Yeah, when I was writing the bio, for whatever reason, based on everything else you do and knowing you and knowing what I knew about you, I was like hesitant to use the word magician because it seems different from what you do. And we'll get into all of that and more. You sort of answered my first question, which was going to be like, which came first, magic or theater, and to what extent they were feeding each other. So it sounds like magic came first.
They came at basically the same time. I got really lucky and kind of got exposed to a lot of different things at the same time. And magic and theater kind of grew up together from a really, really young age.
And so were you like the theater kid at school or were you like the magic kid? Because I think those two both exist.
Yes, absolutely. I would say I was definitely a bit of both. In school, there's really a place for theater because you can do school plays. And so there's a community around that. And I was always deep in that world and really cared about it. But I was doing magic too, never really within theater. They were pretty separate. I would, you know, go, my parents would drive me on weekends and I'd do gigs at parties and Renaissance fairs. Shout out King Richard's Fair. Well, the costumes were pretty unbelievable. I don't know if I have good pictures. I'm sure my parents do. I think there was a point where my magic mentor said to me, I think you might be more interested in staging and designing and choreographing all this magic than you are in doing it. And it turns out he was really right. I truly don't perform anymore. That isn't what I loved about doing it, but there was something about putting impossible things on stage that was really exciting to me and telling stories around that, that captured me at a really young age and has, I guess, stuck with me until now.
It's fantastic. I was going to ask, like, can you remember why you got interested in this in the first place? Like, was there a movie or even a magician or a piece of theater that you were obsessed with?
Yes. I can think of the theater answer and the magic answer. Theater answer. Oh, it was so, I was in love with puppets. It was like two or three. Wow. I really was obsessed with puppets. And this kind of specifically dates me, but Julie Taymor went to my public high school too. And The Lion King opened on Broadway when I was very little. And that was my first Broadway show. And I think the combination of loving puppets and the way my parents described me watching that is that, you know, I was pretty young to see a big long show and I was on the edge of my seat with my mouth open and my eyes open the entire time. That's part of what set it off. Also, the VHS tape of Pippin was a big part of my childhood for some reason. I like definitely affected me deeply and still something I refer to and think about a ton. From a magic perspective, I got a magic kit for my aunt and uncle for a birthday and I immediately went in the other room and popped in a VHS with all the instructions in it. And I was totally hooked. It really, I never thought about magic a moment before that moment. And suddenly I was completely hooked. And within a few years was a member of the Society of Young Magicians, which is an arm of a national magicians organization. I was performing. I went to circus camp for a while. You know, like it's really, I got deep into that world. And I don't know if at the time I could have pointed out why I liked it. But I think part of what draws me to theater too, and what I guess has helped magic stick around in my life is that I am most excited by theater when it shows us back the world, not as it is, but how we feel it to be. And I think magic at its best is really emotional in that way, in that it can confirm an internal experience in a really validating way, where it makes the impossible thing we feel the world to be inside of us real in front of a group of us. Not always. Sometimes it's, you know, tricks with some cards and rings and things. But at its best, that's what it feels like to me.
That was such an amazing, articulate answer. Beautiful and touching. I wanted to ask, I feel like there was a moment in pop culture, I want to say when we were in like middle or high school, when two magic movies came out at the same time. It was like The Illusionist and something else. You made
The Prestige, yes. I think, came out that same year,
yes.
Right?
Did you see those and say, like, I'm validated? Or were you like, now everyone's going to be into magic and it's my thing?
Oh, I never thought everyone was going to be into magic when I saw those things. I mean, we'd already, you know, I'd grown up with Harry Potter, which I feel like was a big part of that, and performing at different, like when the Harry Potter movie would premiere, they'd hire a bunch of magicians to come perform at those premieres. And so we were always kind of growing up with some magic mythology, I think, as part of our lives. I think the truth is, it really fascinated me. The magic pop culture moment that, and this is dating me again a little bit, is on HBO, there used to be a special called The World's Greatest Magic that they'd air that was like a variety show of all of the best magicians in the world performing in Las Vegas. And I taped all of those and would watch them again and again and again. And that was also around the moment when, you know, David Blaine had a TV show and Chris Angel had a TV show. And we had this kind of huge amount of magic content that I think was easily parodyable for good reason.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely like, I think people forget, A, that magic was part of the vaudeville scene. So it came up at the same time as like theater and entertainment. And two, that like magicians have been cool. I think people think of them as like the stereotype of the nerd, but wasn't David Blaine in the Pussy Posse famously?
Oh, he might have been. I mean, first of all, he's actually a very good magician. I think it's like easy because he has such a funny TV past, but I can say from inside the magic world, in my opinion, he's very good at what he does. I mean, I don't know that magic's cool. I don't know that I, if I like deeply care about it being cool either. I think I think some of the nerdiness of magic is watching people try to be cool while doing it. I think that that's the lack of embrace of sincerity, because I think it is a very fundamentally sincere, I'd call it an art. It's something between an art and a craft, but I think an art, I think that it definitely attracts a certain kind of mind. And I think you'll see that across folks who do magic, that there's something singular and determined about a lot of people who do magic, because they're just constantly having to deal with making impossible things possible. And I think that, you know, in any field where you have to do something like that, you get a very specific kind of person and kind of approach to doing that. So I've felt very lucky. You know, I was outside of anything I would call a magic community for a very long time. I don't know if I'd even call myself, like, I could honestly call myself a member of a magic community now, but I am part of a really amazing community of magic professionals who make magic in theater. And there aren't a ton of us, but they're really lovely, special people. One of the joys of what I get to do is collaborate with them.
Yeah. I mean, to me, as someone outside of that, but within the theater world, to me, it sounds like what you do, and certainly what you've done for Harry Potter, what I imagine it is like stage combat or even choreography, in that you're teaching these actors really detailed, specific movements, essentially, or am I completely on the wrong track?
No, you're on the right track. I think what's tough about it is that it bridges every department in the theater, because every department, I'm not kidding, every department touches almost every piece of magic in the show. Wigs, hair, and makeup touches almost every piece of magic in any show, you know, whether it's Harry Potter or one of the shows I'm designing now. Front of house touches every moment of magic. Everyone is involved. The maintenance folks who run aircon in the building are involved. Everyone is making it. So you have to have your one foot in the design and tech world, one foot in staging and direction, because, you know, as with any choreography, you never want to put it on someone. You want to build it with their performance. And so I can say in Harry Potter in particular, because I've gotten to put so many different people, build so many different companies of that show, you see things evolve, because different people and different bodies and different interpretations of moments mean that the magic grows and changes with the company. And that's what keeps it interesting and exciting when you've set something like 9 companies.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Yes. I want to go back a little bit. So you're in high school, you've been doing theater and magic. You went to Brown Liberal Arts College, great theater department. I imagine somewhat similar to my experience. Did you do that because you were like, oh, I want to get a really good education too? Or were you not really sure you wanted to go into theater professionally? What was the thought process there?
I knew I wanted to go into theater professionally. I knew that very deeply. And I wasn't in a situation where my family wasn't supportive or anything like that. I got to visit some schools and I fell in love with the people at Brown. And that's why I went. I visited a bunch of places. And when I visited, the professors, the students kind of bowled me over. And I feel so lucky that I went to that particular program in the moment I did. Everyone has a complicated relationship to the places they were educated. I should go back and say I went to an amazing public high school that did something like 13 or 14 shows a year, and most of them were directed by students. So I was kind of starting from this place and doing really wildly ambitious things. I co-directed Sunday in the Park with George with my friend David Gore. Shout out David Gore. In high school, we had a playwrights festival. We did A Streetcar Named Desire. We did Caligula. We did Cabaret. Like, it was really, someone was really pushing the limit of high school. We did For Color Girls. We did Twilight Los Angeles. It was a really special and really student motivated program. Of those shows, those 13 shows, I'd say 10 would be directed by students.
Wow.
Every year. And they would all be designed by students. There were, you know, 2 theater faculty in that building. So it was really taught you to kind of light a fire under your butt and pursue things that you didn't know how to do. and make them possible. So that was a really great place to start from. Going to Brown, I got so lucky because it actively worked to shake up what I would say, you know, I thought I knew a lot about theater going to school. I think in some ways I did, but I only knew the version I knew from growing up in a regional theater system in Boston. And it exposed me to like what devising was and like what like durational experimental theater could be, what different kinds of playwriting could do. It brought in a lot of amazing guest artists. And I think that I was also surrounded by a lot of students and classmates who were interested in pushing the boundaries of what theater could do in their work already. And I don't know what I would make now if I hadn't been in that environment, but I'm so happy that I was. And as one of the great gifts of that, a few of my closest friends and my like core artistic partner, Simon, are all folks I met at school there. So I got a lot of gifts from that experience.
I was going to ask, so you come out of Brown, you have this great experience. I believe you started Night Drive with Simon only a year after. You know, I had a previous guest a couple of months ago on the show. I wonder if you would know her, but she started a theater company as well when she was young that's devoted specifically to like women's writing. And I asked her the same question. I was like, what was the impetus for starting that when you were so young? And she felt that there was like a gap and she didn't think that she could make those things without doing it on her own terms. Was it a similar impetus for you guys? What was the development there?
So kind of importantly to the journey, that wasn't the first theater company I'd started. I'd started a theater company with a bunch of friends in Boston when we were still in high school called Circuit Theater. And
can I just point out, sound like the most ambitious on top of his shit high schooler I've ever heard of.
That is a very nice way of saying the most precocious. Yeah. And I definitely was. No, I was in a community of really amazing young artists, even in high school. And I say that because like so many of them are now unbelievable theater professionals in their own right. And I think that's a lot of credit to the kind of support the things we were making had in that community. But we started it because we wanted to do theater together in the summer. And that was really the only impetus. We wanted to make things together. And as we went into college, it kind of grew and changed. You know, a lot of the model at the time, and I think this is changing a lot in a wonderful way, was like going away to very expensive summer theater internship
Definitely.
Programs. And we were kind of like, we want to make plays, not necessarily be interns with other people who make plays. And we don't want to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to do it. And there was this shift where we started, rather than kind of doing work that fit into the Boston world, kind of trying to push the envelope of what was happening in Boston professional theater. And we did the Boston premiere of Sarah Rule's play, Passion Play. It's like a 4-hour play.
My gosh.
We did it with a cast of all actor musicians. We toured, we did it in the church where Ben Franklin was baptized. Ben Franklin and Sam Adams were baptized. We did it at the Oberon at the ART. We kind of toured around the Boston area. And it really changed a lot for us and kind of shifted into a more professional and specific voice model. And I thought when I was in school, I was like, I'm going to graduate and run this company full time. And two big things changed for me in the last kind of 2 years of school. One of them was I had started writing and really fell in love with writing. I was writing with Simon. We wrote a play and we submitted it to this theater, Ars Nova, for Ant Fest, and it got accepted. And I think before that moment, we'd felt like, oh, if we move to New York, it will be impossible to make plays. And we care about making plays and it's just so big. Nobody knew way to do it. And we, you know, we didn't tell them that we didn't live in New York. So they would be like, can you come in for, you know, maybe do a press photo or like a photo shoot for our website? They'd be like, sure. And then schedule it for a weekend and wake up at 5 a.m. and take the bus from Providence, New York, do the photo shoot, leave and take it back. But having that experience going in the summer, going into our senior year, and then we did a show at the Brick that same summer, kind of opened up our mind to like, well, what about New York? And I think there was a combination of that and the feeling that running a theater company, because I'd been running this theater company with so many friends for so long, it felt like it was a harder space to grow in. I think I was really interested in being a small fish in a big pond of artists I really admired and didn't know how to work with and didn't know how they worked. And as long as I was administratively in charge of something, I didn't know that I would have the freedom to go out and learn the same way. So that company kind of like beautifully and softly folded. We brought one show we did in Boston to New York and did it to New Ohio. And that was kind of the end of its journey. At the same time, Simon and I were avoiding starting Night Drive. We were like, we're going to avoid starting a theater company as long as we can because we're not trying to run a theater company. We're trying to make plays together. And I think it was, and we still to this day check in and are like, this company exists for us to make this kind of work together that we believe in. That's a really different mission. And we don't want the company to grow beyond best supporting the artists involved in doing that. Oliver Butler from Debate Society, I remember, said to us when we were in college, everyone has to get their first theater company out of their system. And I think we got to do that. And this is the second theater company that's a result of that, that I think is built with a lot of specific intention and care over time and relationship to its purpose.
So I have had a number of guests on the show who wear multiple hats in the theater space. I like having them on the show because that's what I do. And I'm particularly interested in people that do a lot of different things. But within that, I'm interested in how people started to do that. I also think when we were starting out in the industry, it was a lot less accepted than it is now to do multiple things. And I feel like people were very like, well, are you an actor? Or are you a director? Are you a writer? Or are you this? So how did you get interested in sort of doing it all, plus the magic from the beginning? Was it making all these shows in high school that really set it up for you?
That was a big part of it. I always think of it like a lot of people are kind of horizontal integration of a thing. Like they're like, I'm a writer, but I write plays and movies and TV and books, or I'm an actor and I want to act in everything. And I'm a little more like vertical integration for theater. I'm like, I do all these things.
Right.
And it's all for theater. Not that I necessarily wouldn't, but my brain and heart work in a way that's very aligned with theater. I knew I wanted to direct from a really early age, and writing came a little later. I think I knew I wanted to be a director from like age 10. I was making my friends do plays and we'd do, you know, hang out. And then writing came in high school because there was a playwrights festival that students founded my freshman year. And I was like, whoa. We could do that. We could write the plays. And I think now, you know, in a lot of my practice, those things are so tied together because I'm in this kind of really deep collaboration with someone where we're like, we're writing the plays for me to direct them, for him to be a performer. Those things speak to each other really clearly. When I self-identify to people, I say I'm a director and a writer and I do this really weird job where I design magic and illusions for theater. And I think that's a pretty true description of how I think of myself. The magic design thing has come along relatively recently, but it's become a huge part of my life. I designed a bunch of shows in the last year, and I'm designing a bunch this year. And it's so special to get to walk into other artists' rooms and see how they work and become part of the genesis of developing a new play or a really interesting revival, you know, of a play or a musical, and see how magic can be core to storytelling. And I can bring some of that experience into other people's work. So, I mean, the thing I say to, you know, when I talk to high schoolers or college students who are like, how do you do this? I'm like, don't give up any of the unique things you do. Like, actually, it's a huge mistake, especially because the way I ended up doing so much of this is because I had done magic. Right. And because I could bring those experiences together, I ended up in Harry Potter world. And because of Harry Potter world, I've ended up kind of getting to do so many things I never thought I'd get to do, and taking this pathway that I wouldn't have seen clearly without having those set of experiences.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I definitely think all of these things feed each other. It also seems like where you live in theater is sort of on the experimental side. Like on Night Drive's website, it describes what you guys do as rigorously irreverent, demandingly vulnerable, borderline impossible, seems to be a theme for you, plays that use indelible moments of stagecraft to build thrillingly personal relationships with audiences, empowering them to reimagine themselves and what they're capable of. So first of all, for those of us who aren't as familiar who are listening, can you expand on that? And why were you always drawn to that kind of theater over, say, The Music Man, just to like pick an example?
Yes. And no hate to The Music Man, because I am someone who loves musicals. I love musicals. And one of my dreams is to direct big, weird productions of musicals. They're truly one of the things that brought me into theater and that I love more than anything. I think, okay, so all that big mission language that we spent tons of time on, let's talk about it like human beings for a second. I think the reason anyone does theater or loves theater, whether they participate as a spectator, as an artist, as a technician, as an administrator, anything, is because there are like four or five things they've ever seen that have changed their lives. It's not because we like everything we see. It's not because everything affects us. It's because there are like four or five things that fundamentally altered the way they walk through the world. And there is nothing like it. And then you spend the rest of your life chasing that feeling or chasing creating that feeling for other people. Simon and I joke with our work with Night Drive that we're making experimental theater for people who they hate theater. And I think all that means to us is that we're not interested in experiments that kind of hold theater up as this like, ooh, like it's so weird, it's so special, it's so strange, you don't understand it. Kind of, we're interested in experimenting in ways that theater can feel more live and storytelling can feel more personal, and that you can really be brought into it in ways that feel special to the story. The way we describe it a lot of times, you know, unlike a lot of experimental companies who we love and admire and have inspired us so much, we make narrative work. We make plays that have stories and characters that go on a journey. And we do that because we think narrative is an immersive feature. As so much immersive work is a narrative and a more aesthetic. And for us, we really, what immerses us in work on stage is getting pulled into a story.
Yeah.
But we're interested in taking stories and creating theatrical forms for them that fit them as specifically as, say, a basketball court fits a basketball game. Right? That it's like, if we really love stories, we should be willing to rebuild everything about theater around them to tell them as powerfully as possible. So when we talk about being rigorously irreverent, I think we just mean we work really hard and try not to take ourselves too seriously. We try to intense on the inside of the process. No, but just...
I didn't read your mission statement because I thought it was unclear. I read it because...
Oh, no.
I like it, and because I wanted you to talk more about it and what that means to you as the artist making the work.
I think I have insecurity that it's unclear because we picked it. It's so wordy.
As someone who is in school right now for theater management, we had a whole class where we had to read famous organizations' expanded mission statements. And at least, like yours, it's long, but yours is very specific. Like the word choices you use are specific. They describe something. You would not believe the mumbo jumbo that people have on their 990s to describe what they do.
That's helpful to hear. I mean, and that you're actually singling out part of the big thing for us, which is it's important to come in with a really specific perspective to what we're trying to do. It's important to us. And so I guess the whole thing is that approach to making work applies as much to a production of Our Town or Hello Dolly as it does to, you know, whatever new weirdo play we're doing. And just that if we really respect stories and love stories, if we think stories are great, whether they're new or they're classic, there's nothing we can do that is more respectful and reverent for them than say nothing about this form, theater, is more valuable than what's here, than this story. The thing that keeps theater special is that we all have to show up for it to happen, and showing up, at least in the last few years, has meant in a certain way risking your life. And so thinking about what is worth risking your life to be in the room with other people for, I think there is this something profoundly hopeful that people still show up for theater, and a responsibility as artists to remember that aside from whatever money you're charging or not, people are giving you time in their life they're never going to get back in a way that they aren't in other forms. And that's intense and serious.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think when you were talking about ways of making the story feel even more immediate, making it feel even more live than live, it reminds me of The Grown-Ups, that you would do it for 10 people in your backyard. I mean, obviously, some of that impetus was because of the unique circumstances of COVID, I have heard and I imagine. But, you know, it's a rare example of a narrative piece, as you say, that was also immersive and not just sort of vibey, as you described. So I think totally. That's really cool. If so, what you were saying reminds me, and the kind of things that you're able to do on stage and beyond reminds me. I don't know if you saw this, but there was this hilarious tweet that I keep thinking about. Kill me that I'm saying this hilarious tweet. But it said, like, new American playwrights, all their stage directions are always like, act one, scene one, a pineapple is sitting on stage, and slowly over the course of the act, the stage fills up with pineapples. And it made me laugh so much because, A, it's so absurd, and B, I was like, that is like half of the plays. But I feel like you're the type of person who would figure out how to do it.
Well, that's the thing. It's like everything sounds crazy in writing. And then sometimes you see something and feel it and it just hits. Or sometimes it really doesn't, right? We're experimenting here. One of the plays that was really formative for me, like one of my 5 to 10 plays, I saw one of the first regional productions of The Clean House, which is, she really defined a different way of thinking about American playwriting. Yeah. And in that play in particular, the way language and character and image coexist so seamlessly, like it all has to be that way and it's impossible, was incredibly formative for me. And it is that, like, that's like the good version of the pineapple stage direction, right?
Yeah.
And where you, and I think that the balance is, as a writer, balancing between I am communicating what it feels like to me, and I'm communicating something, thinking about how it will feel to you, if that makes sense. Like, you can write imagistically like that. I think for us, our vibe check is like, if that really happened in space, how would I feel? Like, I'm imagining, like, let's say anything is possible to do on stage, which is certainly something I think about a lot. How would that actually feel to watch? And I don't know, like, in the right play, maybe tons of pineapples appearing on stage would make you weep.
Or laugh. Both are equally valid. Earlier in our conversation, you said that magic was such an important part of your life, and then it was sort of not as much, you know, at the end of college, beginning of your life as like a professional. And then Harry Potter comes along. How did you get connected with them?
So I was directing the little plays I was directing, making the little plays I was making around New York. I was doing a bunch of jobs, and there was a series of stories of how I ended up doing all of those tiny little weird jobs. I was a theater carpenter for a while. I was a virtual butler at a startup.
What?
I was a personal assistant. And I was working at the Tony Awards for my friend Jenny.
Oh, Jenny Gorelick?
Yeah.
We have so many mutual friends that we'll have to play the name game at the end of this recording.
Absolutely.
Not interesting to people, but she and I went to performing arts camp together.
Well, Jenny very kindly hired me to work in the office, the ticketing office that she ran at the Tony Awards at the time. And I think two things were happening. One of them was there was this Scottish company called Vox Movis that I was really into and had been following because they made very different work to Night Drive. It felt like they had a very similar spirit. They did a show at the McKittrick a few years ago called Flight that was unbelievable, but I'd been following them and their work and being like, I feel something, there's something about them that's like the things we do. And I'm really inspired by what they're doing and excited about the kind of shows they're making. I wish I could see them. And then I'd also really fall in love with the work of John Tiffany and Stephen Hoggett. I remember a few years before then, maybe 4 years before then, their production of Glass Menagerie. I was like, oh, that is the thing I feel like I want to do. Like, that is taking a play we think we all know and helping us hear it like it's a new play.
Aren't those moments so amazing when you're like, that's it?
Yes. And so I really was like, I need to figure out how to get in the room with these people. And so those two things were going on in the back of my head. And so I looked up what they were doing next, and they were bringing Harry Potter to the US. And I was looking through the creative team, just wondering who was working on it, and saw that the artistic director of Vox Modus had created the Magic and Illusions. And I was like, I didn't know he did magic, but for some reason, it all makes sense. What a coincidence. And I reached out to him and said, I know you're not going to believe me, but I've been following Vox Modus forever. And, you know, I was in Edinburgh and wanted to see I missed their show Dragon, and I was so bummed. And I was like, I don't know if you'd ever, if you need an assistant or associate or anything, you know, I have this magic background. I run a theater company. I'd love to talk. And we, this again, dates the conversation. We Skyped in the lobby of Signature a few days later and didn't talk about Harry Potter at all. We honestly just, it was this kind of magical connection where we just had so many life experiences in common. Mm-hmm. And it was like meeting yourself, but like a different version of yourself who's capable of thinking differently and seeing things a little bit differently too. And of, you know, in meeting Jamie Harrison, who is that artistic director, you know, the closest thing I've had to a mentor who had such a similar set of experiences to mine and such a similar set of cares and values. And so it was really inspiring. And then at the end of that conversation, he said, listen, I don't know who sent you to me. I was like, I promise no one. He said, well, literally 2 days before you emailed me, general management said we needed to start looking for an associate for the US, but we need to interview everyone. And then there were 6 months of interviews, and they were interviewing, like, as they should, everyone who does magic and had a relationship to theater in New York. And I, at the end of all that, got really lucky and got to be the person doing that job. So it's definitely a sign to like reach out to the people you admire and let them know, because it matters. And yeah, and it was genuinely life-changing. Working on Harry Potter has been genuinely life-changing.
I imagine so. I mean, I feel like your career is so interesting and cool because you have these elements of like downtown Brooklyn, guerrilla theater, scrappy, make it yourselves. And then you're working on like the biggest property in the world with like the biggest budget and the highest stakes. Do you feel that those two experiences feed each other at all, or are they like totally separate worlds to you?
I mean, they totally feed each other. I think the truth of what you learn when you start working in those Broadway rooms is like, all theater is community theater with different size budgets.
Yeah, that's totally
It's actually
true.
All the same thing.
Yeah.
And all of these areas of theater have so much to learn from each other and can grow through each other. My work with Night Drive has gotten better as a result of working in these big, ambitious, really professional rooms. I am better at walking into rooms as a designer or director now on big shows and making things happen and seeing things differently because of my work with Night Drive. So they totally feed each other. And I think they could use a little bit of what each other knows
totally.
To get better. You know, we're in a moment where we're seeing so many of the things that used to be sure bets financially in a commercial theater world crash and burn.
Yep.
And my theory, my hope and theory, so maybe it's not a good theory because there's hope in it, but my theory is the things that are going to start succeeding are the swings, the big swings in the commercial theater world, that where it's something that it's like, oh, what is happening? And it really works in a way you wouldn't expect. It's like the pineapple on pizza effect a little bit, you know, like where it kind of takes you by surprise. And if you're really into it, you're really into it. And there's a following there. And then I think on the flip side, there is real value to thinking about the experience of people who aren't just in the theater world when you're making downtown weird experimental theater, and that, you know, that is actually a theater that should be more accessible to people who don't self-identify as theater fans than commercial theater should be.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. We're in this moment of rebuilding, which I think is sad and weird on one end of the spectrum, but also hopeful. What is your day-to-day like now? Like, is it
oh my gosh.
Equal parts Harry Potter and other stuff? Like, give me a week in the life of Skylar Fox.
I'll give you my next week, because it's what's going down right now. I'm very lucky to, as part of my work at Harry Potter, have brought into our team and worked with some residents and assistants who are now primarily, you know, supervising our shows. So I get to go and visit them and support them.
Oh, nice.
And help the shows that I do, but have folks who, you know, taken charge of those buildings and are running them beautifully. You know, I've shouted a couple of them, but Jesse Freeman on Broadway and our dear Michael up in Toronto, who's also a playwright, by the way, and Jesse runs a theater company called Metaphys Ed. So you really see the like, the spread of theater and magic interest.
Wow.
Chris Fisher kind of supervises this worldwide, and I, you know, help him with that job from a slightly more supervisory perspective at this point. My day-to-day, we're bringing Fat Ham to Broadway. I designed the illusions for Fat Ham off Broadway, and it's coming.
Cool.
And it's going to have more magic. It's going to be bigger and crazier. And we're getting to do so many things we wanted to do off Broadway and now get to really do, which is a total thrill. So I'm deep in the world of that because we start rehearsal soon. I'm last minute designing magic for a new production of Wicked in Brazil. So I'm headed down to Sao Paulo in a couple of weeks to go into tech for that.
Wow.
So it's a lot of designing things. I'm working on a new musical that was just at Berkeley Rep called Goddess. That's pretty amazing. Also directed by Sahim Ali, the director of Fat Ham. A couple of projects I'm not allowed to talk about yet, but are also really exciting. I'm very NDA'd up. That tends to be the way with these things.
Wow.
And so it's working on like four or five different shows every day, which is really exciting and challenging. And just keeping it straight in your head can be a little bit hard. And then in the rest of my life, I'm doing a little bit of directing outside of Night Drive. I'm directing a friend in a short piece he wrote over at The Brick this cool. spring. Night Drive is making new shows. We're working on the first musical we've ever made. And so that's been delightful and also really challenging. And yeah, that's what it looks like. I had a day last week where I was site surveying in the American Airlines for Fat Ham, went into a dressing room, did a Zoom rehearsal for a Night Drive workshop, left, went in and did a call for another play that I was directing, and then finished going across the street and doing a meeting for a new show. So it's like, it's a lot of those days, and it's great. I brought it on myself, and it's a delight.
No, it's good to be busy, especially after, I imagine, a year or two of not.
Total unemployment. Absolutely.
Yes.
Makes a big difference.
You've sort of answered this, but do you have any advice that you would give to aspiring theater makers of all stripes who may be listening?
Yes. Starting out, like, do it. Do it because you care about it. Like a lot of people be like, if you don't care about X and Y, Z much, don't do it. I don't know why they say that. Just do it. If you're asking yourself the question, should I do this? The answer is probably yes in the first place. I think balance. Make sure you are both learning from the people you admire and making your own work. Don't sacrifice either one of those for too long because they feed each other.
Yeah.
And you need the input and you need the output. It like gives you flow and allows you to grow into who you want to be as an artist. Ask for the things you want, which is easier said than done. But I can say at this point, when I'm finally at a point where people start asking me for things versus me asking for things, it doesn't feel bad to be asked for help. Anyone who is in a place where they can be asked for help has had to ask for help. And it actually feels nice. So don't be afraid to ask people for advice, for coffee, for the things you need. I still ask advice all the time. There are so many things I don't know about. I need support on, and I'm lucky to have people in my life or who become part of my life who are willing to do that. And or assume anything is impossible to put on stage. I think I sometimes hear people say, well, that's how we do it if it were a movie. And that's always for me. I'm like, whoa, backtrack. We can do anything on stage. Anything is possible. It's not just the money question. It's not just the time question. It's not just the skill question. You solving impossible problems is going to make better theater and going to push not just your artistry forward, but I think the whole form forward.
I think it's so true. I just wrote about this on Arts Journal partially, that I hate the perspective that film is better. You know, I'm not getting into a competition about which is better, but some people definitely hold the view that film and TV is better because the camera is more agile and able to do different things. And certainly the camera is agile. It's a great instrument. But stagecraft is equally agile. People forget that. Like, people assume that all it is a proscenium where you look at people talking at each other for 2.5 hours. And it's great sometimes when it's that, but it's not just that.
And even when it is, I think that what's exciting about theater is the limitation.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. The camera is limitless. And the thing about film is, like, if you need a dragon, you can make that dragon. Yep. But the thing is, no one in the theater watching that movie is going to believe you actually had a dragon. And the thing you can sometimes do on stage, if you do it really well and right, is give the momentary feeling, because you overcame an impossible limitation, yeah, that there is a dragon. And I think there is something full in limitation. There is something honest and human about telling stories in a form that has limitations. I think if sometimes, if we push against those limitations, we see the limits of the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And that helps us see ourselves more clearly. When we don't fit into the way it would happen in a movie, when real time doesn't work that way, and when scenes last longer than the cut would in a film, we actually come into conversation with the assumptions we make about our experience and where they differ from what it's really like to be alive. I think the theater is all about its limitation, and that's why I love it.
Definitely. Yeah, I think there's this, something else I read. In film, you know, of course, logically, that it was filmed earlier and it's actors. Some people like it better because it's easier to forget. I like theater because that doubleness is always there. You can see the actor sweat. You know that the character is not sweating, that actor is sweating. And living in that doubleness is really interesting to me. I lied. My last question before my quick ending segment. Do you have goals or hopes for the future of Night Drive? For yourself,
yes. Oh,
I
my
guess
gosh.
I could ask, but thornier question. I feel like people don't like talking about their, you know, 5-year plans.
You know what? I don't have a 5-year plan, but I can take my own advice and say the things I want out loud. For Night Drive, we're making big, ambitious shows. I think they're getting to a point for us where they're a little bit too big for us to necessarily produce the premieres on our own. So we've been working on figuring out how to find the right partners to do that. I mean, we're making this one play that is a massive focus group that's performed with the actors and audience around a magical table that does a lot of impossible things. We're making a musical, which is huge. We're making a play that is also a football game.
There's a
series of things that are pushing the limits of what we know how to do. And we are excited to find the partners to help us bring those into the world. So I think that's one thing. We started to tour our work with the grownups. We had 2 tour stops in 2022. We're excited to keep, you know, it takes us so long to make a play. It usually takes us 2 to 3 years to make any one of our plays. It's nice when they can have a long life for the artists and also, you know, expand our audience community outside of New York. I think those are our big Night Drive dreams. And for me, I mean, outside of that, I've been loving making magic for people's shows. I like directing other things too. I said this earlier, like, I want to direct big musicals. Come and get me. You know, like, I have my list of big classic musicals that I think there's still a different production or a different way in that I'd be really excited about. And same thing for some big weird plays. So I'm figuring out how to do that. There isn't a path for directing revivals of things in the way there is for new play directing. We haven't quite figured that out yet, and that's okay, but I'm trying to figure that out for myself. And ultimately, I just want to make things I care about and believe in with people I love. And that can be in my backyard, clearly, or that can be over at the Lyric, either way.
Beautiful answer. Agreed. Yeah, I think to make revivals, it's like, you're Daniel Fish or you're Bart Scher. It's sort of those are the people in the game. And I agree with you. I want to change that. I want to end with my ending segment, which is called the Thank You 5 segment. 5 rapid fire questions. So just answer off the top of your head. Do you have some of these you may not be able to answer? So I have some bonus questions. Do you have a favorite like effect or moment of magic in Harry Potter?
I have 2. The phone booth, if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. And that is the one that visually stunned me the most when I encountered it the first time. And Polyjuice, because it's so different depending on who's doing it.
Fun. Okay. Similarly, what do you think is the most difficult trick or effect to perform in Harry Potter?
I would definitely throw Polyjuice up there because it is so elemental. The thing I should say to the folks who haven't seen the show, the language of magic in Harry Potter is, I love it so much. I can say that because I didn't design it. Jamie did. And what he's done is created magic that isn't in tricky boxes, isn't like upstage tucked away in some corner. It is happening dead in the middle of a big empty stage. And it's just some people and some cloaks. And because of that, it is what the actors are doing is like they are professional magicians. It is not being, you know, done for them. They are doing it in collaboration with the crew and stage management and everyone the whole time. It is. So I'd say that is hard. There is another transformation of people late in the show that I don't want to give away, but that is wildly complicated. And as much as I don't want to talk about how it's done, I can say that if you were to know, it would blow everyone's mind. You couldn't begin to fathom the complicated things that are happening to make this very simple thing happen.
Now I gotta know. I guess all of my listeners will have to go watch it if you haven't already. I saw the two-part version, so maybe I have to go back and experience the one part. Now that I'm changing this question, but now that you said it, what are some of the shows on your list that you would love to revive in different ways?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, this is my actually shy. I've got a lot of Sondheim stuff in me. Like there's a very different Merrily and a very different Follies and Little Night Music too, that I really like to do, which is no hate to how brilliantly other people have done those shows, but I just have my own things with them. So those are big ones. I'm thinking really quickly. I have loved Carolina Change forever.
So
it is something that I would love to work on in a context that can support really ambitious design for it, because it is, I think, the best contemporary musical theater score we have.
Night Music is my favorite Sondheim, so I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on that, because I've pretty much only ever seen it done as either the instruments or like we're in Sweden and everything's white, which is, you know, great, but there's more to mine there. Do you have a favorite piece of theater that you've mounted with Night Drive?
Oh my gosh. No, it's like, I think the truth of making work is that you grow as you make it. So sometimes you look back at old stuff and they're like, oh, that was so sweet. You know, I have love for all of it.
Yeah.
Truthfully,
yeah.
Truthfully. Exactly. And that's why we made it in the first place. And so I will answer honestly and say, I love our next thing. That's the thing I love. The thing we are making right now is the thing that I have the most love for, because it's the thing that needs it the most right now.
Slee, I was going to ask about making theater during the pandemic, but I feel like we're all done with talking about the pandemic. Lastly, I know you can't reveal any stagecraft secrets, but what would you say, as someone who designs these moments of magic, what would you say are the keys to making a magical moment happen?
Absolutely. I will say that when you are thinking about how to make magical moments happen in the theater, I ask myself four questions in this order, right? Why are we doing this play? Like, what is the thing that is drawing us to this play right now? Why does it feel urgent to us, right? You should be able to answer that and find an answer that you believe in. It doesn't matter if other people believe it. It's about you looking in the mirror and believing it for yourself. The second question I ask are, what are the moments in the play that feel, that got you there, that make you feel that most intensely, right?
Yeah.
The third question is, how could something impossible happening in those moments make you feel them as deeply as they affected you? And then the fourth question is, how would we do it? So the important thing is, there are three big questions before we even get to the how. And the truth is, everyone's smart. Like, we know the laws of physics. I bet you can come up with things without knowing how I would do it that are brilliant that I'd never come up with. Because we're creative, right? But truthfully, people who make theater have an enormous amount of creativity, right? Look, the tools of how magic works because of the internet are out there. You know, you can Google around, you can find out how other people did them. And if you're excited about it, I encourage you to do it. There are also great books that are like at the library. There are magic shops with magic books you can buy. Like, no one is actually hiding the information except for anyone's personal interest. I think that the big thing I keep in mind is, magic is not a series of moves or secrets or any of that. It's storytelling. And what makes it work, or what makes a great moment of magic on stage, is the way you make it matter. And this is me going on a momentary tangent, but just to say, you know, magic has existed as long as theater has existed, even before. I mean, you go back to shamanism in like early human communities, mm-hmm. where they were organizing around ritual storytelling, and magic existed. In Greek theater, there was a job called the thaumaturgy, like dramaturgy, but thaumaturgy, which is a wonder maker, and they'd have to make impossible things happen at the end of plays to make us believe in the gods. And I think that that's a wonderful kind of assignment for ourselves as theater makers, to make wonderful things happen that are profoundly hopeful because they make us think there is more to the world than we already know.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I was very quick to be like, I couldn't do that and I don't think I could do that. But I do think that anyone who makes theater has to sort of make magic, in the sense that if you've ever directed a show, you have probably sat in like the last seat at the farthest corner and said, like, can I see the wings? And like, how can I, you know, hide various things? And that is a form of magic, because it's suspending the disbelief of the world of the play. Even like, you know, quick changes that happen on stage when the witch forms in Into the Woods. That is magical. That is the magic of the dressers making this, and costume designer making this amazing moment happen. So I agree. I didn't know that about Greek theater. That's really interesting.
It's wild. I mean, the thing I'd go so far as to say is everything on stage is magical.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I would say that because of its limitation, right? You think about the most basic theater you can think of. How do I cut a full-size house in half and stick it on stage? That's magical when you think about it.
Definitely.
Now, is it always impactful? When something becomes a convention, is it impactful? Who's to say? Depends on the situation, right? Depends on what we're trying to do. But theater is the act of constantly solving impossible problems and always coming up short, because you cannot be reality. You can only be the thing you are in theater, but it's about failing in interesting ways that are human and affecting and moving. In a way, you brought up film earlier, you know, film is all about succeeding at showing something. And I think that theater is all about the interesting failure to get to something.
Yes. Such a smarty. Such a smarty. This has been the best conversation. Like I said at the beginning, before I started recording, rather, when I was like brainstorming guests, as soon as I thought of you, I was like, I can't believe I haven't had him on before. This is so great. And you're clearly the most busy person alive. So thank you for making the time. Is there anything else you want to say or plug? I know you have some Night Drive things coming up, Harry Potter stuff.
Yeah, I mean, follow Night Drive Plays. We're at Night Drive Plays on Instagram, on Twitter, whatever you like. We'll keep you updated. There's also at nightdrive.org a mailing list. If you want to join and find out about the next things we're doing, come see Fat Ham on Broadway. Yeah. Please, please, please. It's a really special show and will be a really
what
fun.
Theater?
It's at the American Airlines.
Oh, fun. Is it Roundabout?
Yes.
That's doing it? I feel like.
No, it is a commercial production in Roundabout's theater. So the public is co-producing it with No Guarantees, with a couple of lovely producers who are wonderful. And it's the original cast coming back to do it. So I'm plugging that away. And I don't know, other people tell me what's good to see right now. I need to go out and see some theater. So if anyone has plugs, let me know.
It's funny, because I was doing my little research on you to prepare, and obviously I had looked up your bio through the Harry Potter website. And so now even though I've seen it, I keep getting like so many Harry Potter ads. And I noticed that, I guess this week is House Spirit Week. I should ask, do you identify with a house? And if so, which house?
That is a great question. When we started doing Harry Potter, you had to take the Pottermore quiz, because we'd run house cups during the rehearsal process.
Fun.
And when people like missed entrances and stuff, they'd lose points for their house.
Oh my God.
But I'm a Ravenclaw. I didn't think I would be. I was a surprise Ravenclaw, but I'm very honored. I feel like it's one of the few houses where it's like a kind of a compliment.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, good. Thank goodness.
I'm a Ravenclaw.
What about you? There you go.
There you go. I think that makes sense for you. You're so smart and cerebral and like creative. So that all makes sense. What did you think you were going to be?
I was like, I'm a strong personality person. So I was like, I don't know. I think I'm going to be a Slytherin or a Gryffindor, one of the two. I'm going to be at one of the ends of the spectrum. But I think my little bit of Harry Potter knowledge that has stuck in my head, you know, sometimes people get put in the houses they need to grow into more than the houses that they are naturally. So maybe that's me learning to be smarter and more studied and more careful.
I can't see you as a Slytherin. I could see you as Gryffindor, but.
But the moral of the play is you can be nice and a Slytherin.
Yes, 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 yes. But Okay, some of my favorite people are Slytherins. I'm not saying it's not nice.
Exactly.
It's like the ability to gossip in a fun way. Like, I definitely think I have Slytherin tendencies. Fun. Yeah, I was looking at it and I was like, I wonder how that actually works. Like, each performance is like people who self-identify as Ravenclaw and then they go. Is that how it works?
Basically, yeah. And you get like themed treats. There are different events and performers
and
things.
Smart.
They really do it up.
That marketing team, man, that's so smart.
I mean, they've been doing great work. I think the truth is the challenge for forever with Harry Potter, it's easier with a one-part play, right? When you didn't have to educate an audience on getting to two parts, but is bridging a lot of different audiences, is saying to a theater, a serious theater audience, hey, this is a serious piece of theater made by a bunch of people who really care about theater. You know, I think one of the most beautiful moments in that show is when Albus and Scorpius see Hogwarts for the first time, and there's no scenic change, just the theater itself glows. And it's this moment of, you know, the play is a love letter to theater and the way in which it was like a place for misfits and a place for this team, who I think a lot of them grew up feeling that way, and that it's a place where those things that made them not fit other places felt like superpowers. You know, there are a lot of problems with the Harry Potter canon.
Sure.
That I'd be very happy to dig into and its creator. But I think the beauty of the play is that. And on the flip side, there are people who don't care about theater but love Harry Potter. And, you know, this is something that they would love. So I think figuring out how to broaden who a theater audience is has been a big project of this marketing team. And I'm excited to see what they keep doing.
Yeah, it's fun and creative for sure. Amazing. Thank you for plugging those things.
Thanks for letting
Paulo,
me.
This has been the best conversation. Thank you, Skylar Fox. Thank you, Call Time listeners. As always, another really great guest coming up next week. So stay tuned for that. And